Welcome back. This is a continuation of Health and Human Services and Housing. We are currently hearing Senate File 511. Before we continue, I just want to make an announcement that I hope that you'll communicate to everybody who comes in here this evening that we have three things we're going to finish up on this bill, and then we're hearing Senator Hoffman's bill and then the e-cigarettes bill. So during this committee meeting, the use of e-cigarettes will not be permitted. Please communicate that. It will not be permitted in this hearing room, and I expect that people will honor that limitation. We need to have that to ensure the comfort of everybody in attendance. So with that, I will take the table, and Senator Wicklund. Thank you. Thank
Senator
you
Sharon.
Let's see here. Do I have a packet for today? Hello, Senator Wicklund. Thank you. I want to thank all the testifiers who came and presented on this bill today. I don't know if there are any questions from members, but I would entertain any questions from members of Health and Human Services and Housing at this time.
Members, do you have any questions for Senator Sharon? Hearing
well,
no
seeing
other
none,
questions.
That I would make a motion to lay it on the table for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Senator Sharon moves that Senate File 511 be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus licensing bill. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? Hearing none, motion passes.
Thank you.
Welcome.
Hoffman's massage therapy. Duplicating, and I had a. We switched the numbers around. I thought this was going to take longer, so what do we do? The bell.
Okay.
We had it was handed out earlier today. I don't know if people saved it. I was made copies. It was handed out earlier. All right, let's go.
And I'll.
I know some of the names in there. Apparently.
Oh, yeah, oh, yeah. All right, well. I'm going back to the
table. You want to be back for e-cigarettes?
Yeah, so you just need me. Just send these guys up.
So, thank you.
Thank you.
You've been here all day.
I've been here all day.
How about that?
And I thought I saved my stuff, but...
Thank you. Welcome to the to your committee again, Senator Hoffman. Appreciate the chance to hear from you on Senate file. What Senate file are we on here?
792.
1792. I understand you have a author's amendment, or is it an author's amendment?
Yes, Madam Chair. Thank you. And I'll go into a little bit of detail on the author's amendment. But
excuse me, I'm sorry to interrupt you, Senator Hoffman, since I've invited you to speak, but we are not handing out additional copies of the bill. It was in our materials earlier, so you should refer to that in your earlier packet of material. Thank you. Please continue, Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The Senate File 1792 is Minnesota Massage and Bodywork Therapy Act, and joining me at the table tonight is Jeremy Miller, Government Relations Chair of the American Association of Chapter of Massage and Bodywork Therapy and Therapy Association of the Minnesota Chapter. And then Gary Myers, who's a regional developer for Massage Envy, was going to be here this afternoon. I have his testimony, which you all should have a copy of. I'm going to read it just because of the fact that they employ over 500 massage therapists right here in the great state of Minnesota. Senate File 1792, I'd like, Madam Chair, to move that it pass and be sent to the state and local committee and also be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus licensing bill. In front of you, committee members, is the A5 amendment, and I would like to move the A5 amendment. With the adoption of this amendment, what it does is all the professional associations who have expressed concerns with the bill in the past were willing to come to the table are now either in full support of the bill or neutral.
Well, thank you, Senator Hoffman. Senator Hoffman offers the A5 amendment. Are there any questions or discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Nay. The A5 amendment passes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The legislation has been developed over the past 8 years and would create a uniform voluntary registration process that will provide peace of mind for clients, employers, and healthcare professionals that they are working with vetted professionals who are bound to an enforced standard of conduct, meet certain criteria and educational standards, and pass a background check as required for other healthcare professionals. The bill grants those qualified registered massage and bodywork therapists the title protection RMBT, another acronym we can add to the list. This proposal was reviewed by the Minnesota Council of Health Boards during a 6-month process, and Madam Chair, their report found that there is an overall compelling state interest in regulating this industry to protect public health and safety from the actions of unqualified, the improperly trained practitioners who are not currently regulated proactively by the state. Madam Chair, we have 33 schools in Minnesota that are training massage therapy students. All of those schools, every one of the 33 program hours, exceed the minimum education standards found in this bill. Madam Chair, passage of this bill will not change the number of students attending these programs for the better or for the worse. On average, massage and bodywork therapists work in 2 practice locations and are currently required to become licensed, wait for multiple weeks to multiple months, and pay fees in every city where they intend to work. This singular state voluntary registration credential would dramatically simplify the regulatory burden on these small business professionals. Also, Madam Chair, those massage and bodywork therapists wishing to remain in practice under 146A may continue to do so now and in the future. This is important. This bill does not change requirements for those who practice massage under 146A. Under their city license, under their athletic trainer registration, under their nurse's license, or under their physical therapist license. So, Madam Chair, with the addition of the amendment, I believe we have addressed all the concerns of the associations that have engaged us on the bill. A long list of those associations is in your packets. You can see who all was part of this collaborative effort. You will also find a statement of full support of Senate File 1792, from the League of Minnesota Cities, which is also in your packet. That's a 2-pager. I would ask your support for volunteer registration, and at this time I'd like to turn it over to Jeremy Miller for additional comments. And Madam Chair, just one more thing. I am going to read Mr. Myers' testimony just so we have it for record. So, Jeremy Miller.
Mr. Miller.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senator Hoffman. My name is Jeremy Miller. I'm a massage therapist. I'm one of 8 full-time massage therapists who work at Abbott Northwestern Hospital in Minneapolis. I'm here today as a volunteer in the role of government relations chair for the American Massage Therapy Association's Minnesota chapter. The professional massage and bodywork therapy is practiced by an estimated 5,200 individuals in the state of Minnesota. A real need exists for this state regulation. The number of actionable complaints in the 44 other states, including all of our neighbors who have a proactive credential, bear this out. The need for a state-level regulation is further supported by the Council of Health Board's report on massage therapy and by data from liability insurance claims from right here in Minnesota originating from Minnesota clients who have been physically harmed by treatment injury. In the report on occupational regulation, the Pew Foundation uses the massage profession as an example of a profession ideally suited for regulation, as this level of regulation is a legislative response that is proportionate to the risk involved to the public. Senate File 1792 gives each massage and bodywork therapist the choice to stay under the status quo of their local mandatory licensure at the city level, or the choice to become an RMBT, Registered Massage and Bodywork Therapist, whichever works in that individual's business model. Senate File 1792 avoids negatively impacting unregistered practitioners. An unregistered therapist can still practice using the same techniques and even the same advertising that they use today, including the use of the terms bodywork and or massage, so long as they do not advertise that they are state registered. Registration is not creating a slippery slope toward mandatory licensure. Any sliding toward that end would require a whole new act from a future legislature. After numerous stakeholder meetings over the past 4 years since we were last here, I'm pleased to report that we have reached agreement with all those who had concerns and who asked us to make improvements to the bill. You can see in the handout materials the lengthy list of stakeholders we met with and made accommodations for. Position of those associations is listed for 2010 and then also again for now in 2014. In the handout materials, there's also an executive summary of the bill which walks through the different sections. I'm happy to provide a greater level of detail on any of those sections if it would be helpful, but for now, I would simply ask that you support Senate File 1792 as amended, and I'm happy to stand for any questions.
Thank you. Are there any questions at this time? Senator Hoffman, you wanted to read a statement.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is a statement from Gary Myers of Envy Massage. And Madam Chair, members of the community, my name is Gary Myers. No, my name is John Hoffman. I'm a regional. Gary's a regional director for the 4-state area for Massage Envy. We have 24 franchisees in Minnesota employing over 500 massage therapists. He was here this afternoon today supporting Senate File 1792, and in his words, he wants to tell you how the current patchwork of local regulations are negatively impacting the small business and the individuals that are employed by Massage Envy. And he gives some points. Number one, if a therapist needs to work at another massage business in a different city, sometimes only a handful of miles away, that massage therapist is required to purchase another license, often at additional cost of $300 to $400, and sometimes more. It doesn't matter if that therapist is just filling in for another therapist who called in sick at another Massage Envy, or if that therapist, a self-employed entrepreneur who simply works in multiple locations like so many practitioners do. Number two, the current city licensure process takes 30 to 90 days for a background check and processing. This is 30 to 90 days that a person is without pay. What Gary says is we could employ them immediately with a registration as provided by this bill. Number three, massage therapists working in border cities in Minnesota will now be able to have a much easier pathway to reciprocity with the surrounding states and vice versa. All the surrounding states have a state-level regulation of massage and bodywork therapists, and these therapists will be able to move easily to work in Fargo, Moorhead, Duluth, Superior, or Woodbury and Hudson. So he asks that this volunteer registration bill be passed so we can remove the multiple regulatory barriers that many massage professionals face as they practice their business. This bill will reduce the financial time and paperwork burden that currently exists under the patchwork of local regulations for those individuals who independently choose to register. Madam Chair, that's the testimony of Gary Myers.
Thank you very much. Are there any questions at this time?
Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Hoffman, are there any states that have gone to a licensure for a massage therapist?
A full state licensure, Madam Chair. Senator Rosen, I believe the bordering states have that right now, currently.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator Rosen.
Is that something that's of interest to the Massage Therapist Association?
Madam Chair, Senator Rosen, I'd like Mr. Miller to answer that. I do have my own opinion on that, but I bet you it's yes.
Thank you, Senator Hoffman. Mr. Miller?
Madam Chair, Senator Rosen, the position of the American Massage Therapy Association is that the ideal situation of regulation is for mandatory licensing, but after many years of compromise and hard work on a bill, we have scaled back to be inclusive of all the input from all the different associations and all the different opinions around the profession, and have settled on the registration level of regulation here in Minnesota, which Statute 214 defines as a voluntary credential, title protection.
Thank you. We have some other testifiers. It might be good to move through the testimony and then ask again if there are any questions from the committee. The next person on our list is Kathleen Picard, physical therapist. Thank you, Kathleen. Come forward. State your name and the organization you're representing.
Good evening, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Kathleen Picard. I am a physical therapist, and I am representing the Minnesota Physical Therapy Association. I'm here just as a proponent of this bill. We've worked with the proponents for about 4 years, and I would say at first we did have some concerns in that we did have an overlap in scope, primarily just the tool that we use. Physical therapists are known to use massage in their practice, as are massage therapists. But the scope has less overlap than the tool, and I want to make that distinction. But at any rate, we spent a lot of time together trying to figure out how to shape the scope of practice for massage and bodywork therapists that came to our satisfaction, and we arrived at that. So not only are we neutral, we're supporting this bill because we think it's good public policy. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much, Ms. Picard. Mm-hmm. I appreciate that. I don't know if there's anyone who has questions for Ms. Picard at this time. Otherwise, we can move. If those who have testified would give up your chairs, we have others who have requested to present. Would both Barbara York and Greg Schmidt please come forward and take your place at the table? And that will then, I think, Barbara, you're first on the list if you want to begin. And then when you've finished, would you please release your chair for Diane Miller, who also requested a chance to present in front of the committee. We can have a page come and pick those up from you. Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I am Barbara York. I'm the president of the Minnesota Therapeutic Massage Network. It's also known as the Minnesota Touch Movement Network. We are a group of practitioners supported by other practitioners, supported. The ring keeps going out, and you've been hearing from our opposition with this bill. We've been looking at the 214 since 1987, and we recognize that conversations around this have always been about people being able to call themselves professionals. You can see that in 2010, a very similar bill came up. And this very committee, when Senator John Marty chaired that committee, that he and a very bipartisan examination of it found it not in compliance and therefore could not be passed. The statements that you have before you are from prior to that particular committee meeting. You'll see that the Minnesota Board of Health notification was from 2009. Though this is called voluntary, this would become mandatory, as we've seen in other states, because what happens is that the very people who are interested in having this passed will go to the cities and ask that this be included, and they require, therefore, practitioners within their cities to get the certification, the registration. In comparison to how many people are actually practicing, there's a small number of people who are actually doing multiple city work. It's the majority of the people who are in this practice in any surveys taken around the country, especially with the AMTA, show that the majority of people are part-timers. And so they may not even be able to afford to approach this registration, and especially if it becomes mandatory because of their city. The professional liability insurance that's mentioned in here profits certain organizations, the AMTA, the AMB,
It's okay.
But there's a Colorado insurance group that are very interested in these things, because when you say professional liability insurance, my business insurance has the same coverage, but it's not in the same setting as they're requiring in this. There are also some other concerns that we've had with this, is that there's diagnostic language in the explanation of this. And we know that what ends up with this is a lot of turf wars. It's exactly what you don't want. When we passed the 146A, and if you'll note in our history, we've passed two bills, the 146A and the 609-344. None of the people who are proponents for this bill came to support those consumer bills. And we actually got a letter from the Colorado group to the Minnesota Coalition Against Sexual Assault saying that they could not be party to supporting the bill. We, the people who are opposing this certification, we have passed consumer protection bills that are stronger than anything that you can do with the registration, certification, and even licensure. The 609 took any sexual assault of a client into a category of a felony and as a registered sex offender. We say we already have the regulations necessary for anything that falls into this category, whether it's called massage or body work. Although it would look like I would be part of this as a Jin Shinjitsu practitioner, I would actually, as a sole modality, would not be able to qualify for this registration, especially if my city were to make it mandatory. The MTMN worked with the city of Minneapolis just this last summer. We've been working on sex trafficking issues since 2011 with the Minnesota human rights group that wrote the book for you on sex trafficking, the Advocates for Human Rights. What we found in that is that we have been going to the grassroots. We speak to our churches. We are speaking to small women's groups. Then human rights group is working with legislation, with judges, and with corporations. We have found ways to spread the word between our clients and the public at large through our information that we have. Through that, working with the city of Minneapolis, who the year after we took our training, they went through the training with the Human Rights Coalition. I keep messing up the names, but I'm sorry. The Advocates for Human Rights is right there in 2012. The city realized that they did not need to look at who we were as much as we are a business, and they need the police power of being able to knock on the door, something a licensure board does not provide them. And that's why, even though license and certifications and registrations happen across the country, cities come back and put in massage because they don't have the support from groups like us to define it as a business license and understand that what the cities need is police power to check in on suspicious activity, whether it be with nail salons, aromatherapy salons, or massage parlors, whatever front is used. There's not a question of whether we're legitimate or not. It would be similar to saying, is a pharmacist legitimate or illegitimate if they sell drugs under the counter? No. When they do under the counter, they are a drug dealer. And the same with us. We are, since working with this since 1987, if there was harm from undereducated people, you would be having the Attorney General sit before you with the complaints. That's what they found in 2010, is that the number of complaints of harm, and again, we question whether this is mostly students as opposed to practitioners who have been in the field for a long time, that there is not the harm that you would be looking for. The harm that is there is registered with the OCAP office, and it proves our point that what we passed in consumer protection has worked. What we have going now works. You don't need to reinvent the wheel. We don't need the expense of these hearings, let alone creating boards, creating hurdles for practitioners who may be put out of business in a time when it's just helping them make ends meet. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you.
I will take any questions.
Are there any questions at this time for Ms. York? Mr. Schmidt.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I'm going to give just a little background because I believe that only Senator Rosen and Senator Marty were members of this legislature in 1999 when Chapter 146A was passed. So I'd like to give some of the newer members a little bit of background about how that came to be in the form that it was, because I think it's helpful to know. So Chapter 214 states that no regulation shall be imposed upon any occupation unless required for the public health, safety, or well-being, and it lays out four criteria for those regulations. So as we started out working on natural health issues, it was in support of the four-year naturopaths, one of whom had been investigated by the Attorney General's office for practicing medicine without a license. That group was seeking licensure, and we originally supported that effort, and then we began to read it and realized that it was creating, and I think the term you heard earlier today in your bill, Senator, was about silos, about turf, et cetera, et cetera. Now, the interesting thing about natural health is that many of the practitioners use multiple modalities, so creating specific scopes of practice was going to be not helpful necessarily to consumers. So we started reading Chapter 214. We started reading other things and realized that the level and frequency of harm from the natural health therapies was so low that the legislature realized that the normal way of regulating occupations was not necessary. So what they agreed upon was the language that ultimately became Chapter 146A, which requires practitioners to give a client bill of rights, a disclosure notice about their level of education and training, if any. Some people have had no schooling because they were sort of born healers. I always make the joke, you wouldn't send Michael Jordan to basketball camp. You wouldn't send some healers off to school to try to relearn how to be something that that they naturally were. So I think it's very important that, I mean, Chapter 214 is the statute in Minnesota. You've all sworn to uphold the statutes of the state of Minnesota. And there was a great report done by the legislative auditor in 1999. I think there was a reissue of it in the year 2000. One of the final points that it makes, which I will read, is the basic thrust of the statute, and he's referring to Chapter 214, is that the burden of proof is on the proponents of regulation to make a case for regulation. A threat to public health or safety must be shown to be immediate, not remote, and also substantial. Those are the words of Chapter 214. So I don't think the fact that the proponents have indicated that there have been instances of harm, I don't think the claim was ever made as Chapter 146A was going through that there would never be any instances of harm. The issue is the frequency and severity. I think that you can go to the statistics from the OCAP office and see that there have been very few complaints, and almost none of those have been about the actual practice itself. There have been other issues related. There have been boundary issues. There have been cleanliness issues in some cases, but the vast majority of complaints have not been about the actual practices covered under Chapter 146A, and I will stand for any questions.
Thank you. Are there any questions for Mr. Schmidt at this time? Thank you, Mr. Schmidt. Is Diane Miller with us? Please introduce yourself to the committee and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Diane Miller. I am an attorney with National Health Freedom Action. We oppose this legislation, and we work nationally with over 30 states in this type of legislation. So I came here requested to speak for some Minnesota people. I am a native of Minnesota. I was raised on a farm in Minnesota. Our national offices for National Health Freedom Action are in Minnesota. So we're delighted to be here today to speak with you. We are also one of the drafters of Minnesota 146A, which you have in front of you maybe to be referring to. That is the Minnesota statute that was groundbreaking for the United States that it regulates complementary and alternative health care in a very different way than the conventional licensing statutes. It does not create a scope of practice. It actually provides consumer protection without creating a scope of practice or a turf battle. So this was a very big change, as Greg Schmidt said, and across the United States, we have spent much of our time educating legislators about this type of legislation that Minnesota was the first one to pass. We're very interested in protecting Minnesota's Minnesota 146A. We think it's a great bill. There's many states that are now trying to model after it, and the cities in Minnesota are now realizing that there is a huge difference between protecting the public from sex trafficking and licensing an occupation. So they do not, cities like Minneapolis are taking out the credentialing aspect and just focusing on business license issues, which is a whole different issue. 15 years ago, when we passed this bill here in this committee with Senator Hottinger as chair, this bill was to create protection for consumers that were getting massage, were getting body work, and many other complementary and alternative health care practitioners. So 3 years ago, when we came, this bill was a different kind of a bill. It was a massage licensing bill. It was an exclusive bill, and they've made some changes to it. So those changes, in our opinion, are not adequate for the protection of Minnesota 146A because they have added the municipal aspect on the bottom of the bill. So a city could actually choose to refer to the registered massage therapy people and not allow Minnesota 146A people. So when we're teaching cities about this, and we have met with some of the cities that they hadn't even known about Minnesota 146A, we're teaching them how this works. And as you probably all know, it takes a lot of time to make change happen. And so the work of the United States in terms of letting the holistic healers go forward and practice their profession is a complex web of laws. And we think that Minnesota 146A is adequately protecting consumers in Minnesota. It does a great job. And we also think that if you pass a beginning registration statute, that the cities would then point to the state's preferences, and then it would eliminate Minnesota 146A practitioners. So that aspect of it, it looks like a voluntary title bill, but it's really not a voluntary title bill when it comes to a city's preferences. So when we're talking to cities, we want them to refer to Minnesota 146A for the credentialing approach, and then also to do their own business licensing and protection issues. From a national perspective, Wisconsin has, I'd like to use this term, regulatory creep. Once the burden of proof changes and you start regulating a profession, you let go of that presumption that it is in the public domain. So then the government decides, let's register something, or let's certify it, or let's protect the title only, and it's just voluntary. And then maybe 3 years later, these guys aren't really good at what they do. We're better at this, so let's do the registration, or let's eventually do licensing, because licensing is the most restrictive type of regulation. And it excludes other people from actually practicing things. And this is the agenda. So you start out with a small thing. And in Wisconsin, they just converted from certification to registration and to licensure. In Indiana, they just converted. In Maryland, we were working with them last week, and they had a licensing statute of massage, and they were trying to exclude half of the healing touch and body workers. In the state of New Jersey, they've tried to shut down the Reiki people. In the state of Iowa, they tried to shut down the reflexology people. In the state of Florida, they tried to shut down the Reiki people. So we go all over the United States trying to help people design laws that will not let this happen. And for us to be from Minnesota and to have this great law in Minnesota that already is working is an exceptional gift for us. And we want to protect that. We don't want to go into the conventional mode of registration for a small group of people. The other thing is, when we were here before 3 years ago, this was a massage therapy bill. Now they've changed it to a massage and body work. Healing Touch program has 75 different body workers that they give insurance to, right? There's hundreds of body work modalities out there. They're all working well under Minnesota 146A. And we do not want to have massage and body work lose the presumption of being safe. Once you pass a government bill of registration, you lose the presumption that Minnesota 146A has given us to have all of these healers working under a great act that has prohibited conduct, 28 paragraphs of prohibited conduct right now in Minnesota for a healer, and 18 paragraphs of disclosure. So that bill is a powerful bill. And so we're looking at just the national issues that are happening with this, the tendency to go towards building silos that you were talking about earlier about massage. We're talking about the relationship with municipalities and how they're going to reflect upon the state's actions on this. And we're looking about the long-term intent. What do the massage schools really want to see happen here? They really want to see licensure, and that's an exclusive scope of practice, criminal charges for not being licensed kind of bills. So I came here to, I gave you a 7-page handout, and actually we began to, the attorneys in our national office began to draft this because Representative Liebling in the House had asked, what are the criteria for licensing a profession? 214, Minnesota Statute 214 tells us why you license a profession. And she said, let's answer these questions. And so we tried to answer her additional questions, and I hope that you are able to read through the reflections that we have given to Minnesota on this bill, how this bill is going to impact the country, because everybody's watching us on this, and also just to reflect on the fact that if we can educate further about the power of Minnesota 146A, and implement it further. Keep going with it, because it's a really powerful piece of law. And not get into a turf battle or a one-upmanship. That would be really great. And that's all I have to say. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much, Ms. Miller. Are there any questions from the members of the committee at this time? Seeing none. Are there any questions in general on this bill for Senator Hoffman? Yes, Senator.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd just like to thank Senator Hoffman for bringing this bill forward. I strongly support it. I can see he's done extensive work with all the stakeholders, and this bill is well crafted. It's a good bill, and it's definitely ready for prime time.
Are there other questions or statements, Senator Egan? Senator Hoffman, to the testimony, I would ask you to offer a response to the concern that that there is language that would allow cities to restrict those who are currently under 146A overseen in a way that assures safe, qualified practice. Can you speak to that? Is that something that needs to be tightened up, or do you have a response to that?
Madam Chair, thank you. I do, and Jeremy Miller come up here because this guy forgets more in a day than I'll ever know regarding this. But, you know, there's a couple provisions. In this bill, 146A does not stop you from providing the services under the protections of 146A. We made that very clear. Each city, municipality, has general operating licenses that they bring forward, regardless of what your business is. What this specifically does, and I'm going to give a prime example. On University Avenue, Dr. Matt Gravel has he's a chiropractor, and he has therapists that come in, massage therapists that come in and provide the modality of therapy in conjunction with what they're doing with his chiropractic care. He's also got some OTP. He's got the whole look at things. One of the massage therapists that is there, she's licensed in four different cities and is paying. This bill itself would save her about $800 a year because it would allow her to register centrally as a massage therapist because of the work that she does. That's an anecdotal statement. But it should not change anything under 146A, which are the provisions are. And if you look into your packets, committee members, Madam Chair, there's a letter from the city, Minnesota League of Cities, that specifically spells out 146A and what this bill truly does on the protection side of it. So I would that's a five-minute quick read for you. But if I just looked at Jeremy and said, did I forget anything?
Mr. Miller?
Madam Chair.
I think it's Miller, yes. Two Millers on the list here, so Mr. Yeah. Mr. Jeremy Miller.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Eaton, Senator Hoffman, the bill that we're looking to enact would exempt an individual therapist who's chosen to become a registered practitioner in the state. I would exempt them from the city-to-city therapist licensing. The cities could theoretically pass ordinances that would require registration. The cities could right now require that every practitioner in the city graduate from a school with 2,000 hours of training, which hardly any have. The cities could pass ordinances that say that massage therapists to get the city license have to get a letter from a doctor saying they don't have venereal disease, which many cities have in place right now. A lot of cities, unfortunately, are regulating this profession, not to regulate this profession in particular, but to try to curb out prostitution. And so this bill would help address the legitimacy of the profession and would help to get the practitioners out from under this patchwork of city licensing, which is something, as Senator Hoffman mentioned, that the cities are in full support of. So,
I'm not sure that I'm clear yet about whether or not those who currently are practicing massage and body work under 146A, why that is not adequate to do what it is that you believe is important to do.
Madam Chair, the provisions of 146A are not changed by this law at all. The practitioners who are working under that, if they choose not to become registered, can continue to practice. And if for them in their business model, if that works well, they can continue to practice under 146A and continue to practice as the status quo, just as they do now.
And so you're saying that that stays as a baseline, but this, if on a voluntary basis, if the person registers, is exempt from city-to-city regulatory process, but it doesn't preempt 146A.
It does not preempt 146A. Well, the practitioner would be under the jurisdiction of the advisory council that this bill establishes. And so they would
whether they're registered or not?
Well, I'm sorry, if the practitioner is chosen to become registered, they'd be under the jurisdiction
yes.
of the advisory council. If they choose not to become registered, they'd be under the jurisdiction of whatever city licenses are in place and statute 146A. So that's the choice for a practitioner is they can either continue under the status quo with the city licensing and 146A, or they can get registered with the state and be under the jurisdiction of what we're trying to pass with this new law.
Are there other questions? Would you like to approach the table and make one more public testimony? Very brief, please.
2 points. The chiropractor. I'm sorry, I'm Barbara York, Madam Chair.
Thank you.
2 points regarding the chiropractor in St. Paul. There is a state law that was passed just a couple of years ago that allows that massage therapist to work for the chiropractor without any city licensing because they come under the chiropractor's bill. Scrutiny. I can get that information to you. And the other part is that it's the question of calling it voluntary. The city can make it mandatory. That's the difference that we're talking about. We're talking about, yes, you can choose to be registered or work under 146A, but the city can say you have to be registered. And that's what happens is that it gets pushed along as a good idea when actually the city is dealing with prostitution and sex trafficking, and that's a movable target. And what we did in the city of Minneapolis, and I think it will spread, is that it's strictly a business license, and that can be a very simple thing. Minneapolis has reciprocity with the other cities. That was one thing that the League of Cities could not satisfy to the previous hearing, was that the cities could not agree. And that's what. And so the committee said, "Well, why don't you work out the business with the cities instead of making the state do your business?" So what we're saying is that city licenses can get simplified to just a business license, which gives police power to check anything that is questionable. The 146A covers the question of education and any other concern that the consumer has. And like Diane pointed out, we already have the protections that the consumer needs. It's already done.
Well, Ms. York, just one question. Yes. The League of Cities is indicating that they prefer this approach. The cities, and there's been testimony that indicates that the cities can, whether this passes or not, do all sorts of things under their authority.
I'm sorry that Senator Marty isn't here to be able to speak to how that came down to be. The League of Cities isn't necessarily attended by all cities, and there are cities who don't have a licensure or have anything at all. It appears coordinated, but unfortunately it has many different levels. And we've seen the League of Cities get hurt in some of these hearings. And so the point is it's already covered, and there's a simplification that's been realized by cities who are looking at this. Minneapolis has not had any kind of regulation on this issue because they have focused on prostitution issues. But the sex trafficking, we need to be able to knock on the door, and that's what their bill, what their ordinance provided, is a knock on the door, walk in without having to get a warrant. They can't wait for a licensing board to help them when they have suspicion. Otherwise, they don't have complaints about us. I can get you that information from any city council person in Minneapolis at this time. We are not a problem.
Is there anything in this legislation that prohibits the city from doing that, Senator Hoffman?
They have that. I'm sorry.
Is there anything in this legislation that changes that authority?
No, Madam Chair, members of the committee, nothing changes that authority. That's truly, and if you look at the League of Minnesota Cities statement regarding, they specifically spelled out 146A, but there's nothing that stops the cities, that prohibits the cities from doing this within this bill at all. It's the same as it is. The only difference here is you got individuals now that are going to be registered within the state as a licensed body and get some consistency in there.
Are there other questions for the yes, Senator Nino?
Thank you, Madam Chair. One of the concerns that I've heard is that cities could, maybe out of convenience if for no other reason, simply create a city ordinance that requires, in order to practice in their city, you have to go through this registration process. And in that event, it becomes a de facto mandatory registration. It's no longer voluntary. And I guess I'm somewhat sympathetic to that concern. If there was language that was added into this proposal that would preempt cities from requiring that, not preempt their ability to regulate in general, as the league would be opposed to, but to preempt making a de facto mandatory registration, would that help with some of your concerns?
Ms. York?
Madam Chair. I believe the city remains has the sovereignty to make that decision. I don't know that we can preempt that for them.
I think the question is whether or not, if we wrote language, could we preempt the city's authority to change from a voluntary to a mandatory? And did you want to respond to that, Senator Hoffman?
Yeah, Madam Chair, getting to the point, each city has their own operation as they see deemed, you know, important by the city council. And I can give you a handful of cities where they limit the amount of massage therapy, general business operating licenses that are in their cities. Some of them are right in our backyard. I don't know how this would – I don't see a heavy hammer on this one at all, Senator Nienow. I mean, it's the cities are going to choose to do what they do, and that's why it's important that people stick with the cities. This purely just says, look, we're going to have a central point of licensure for those individuals that want to have that licensure. Because not only that, is they're also nationally certified. Most of these folks that are graduating St. Paul College, I mean, they get a national certification. And so this just takes it that one more legitimize. And again, refer back to the League of Cities letter, which spells out some pretty good information.
Senator Nienow.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just to be clear, two points there. We absolutely do have the authority to do that for cities. We absolutely could do that in this legislation. The question for you, and I guess you can't answer for everybody, but if we were to put that into a piece of legislation like this that moves forward, would that make it more comfortable? Maybe I'll just leave that rhetorical. And Senator Hoffman, I guess the question –
before you go to another question, I would like a clear answer as to whether you're uncomfortable with that request, Senator Hoffman, and if so, why?
You know, Madam Chair, I guess the we could look at that going into the next level, but my current understanding, what I do know is that nothing's going to stop a city from doing what they want to do, and yeah, I suppose we could do that, but then is that seen as we're letting local authorities not dictate how they want to see their municipalities? I mean, that's a question that can be talked about. I'd be more than happy to talk with Senator Nienow about that. But
I'd appreciate that you would explore that.
Absolutely, Madam Chair.
And we'll probably be laying this on the table. It might have an opportunity to come around again.
Yep.
Senator
Well,
it goes to state and local government, but it will be reconsidered for inclusion in our omnibus bill. Senator Nienow.
I don't want to belabor the point. Senator Hoffman has kind of made some overtures here to talk. I just was going to say that if the intent is to, like some of the opponents have expressed concerns, if the intent is to slowly creep into statewide registration, this very well could end up doing that if cities simply out of convenience said, we don't want to maintain the cost of regulating this. We think that the state standard is good enough and our city ordinance says, go register with the state, and it's convenient for the cities. There may be some cities that don't do that, but a lot of them could. Probably a lot of the smaller cities or suburban areas that don't want to deal with it. If the intent is to absolutely maintain the option for practitioners to have a voluntary registration, and by definition then a voluntary non-registration, I don't know that I see any harm in putting that preemption language in there, but right now is probably not the best time to have the conversation.
Thank you. Senator Hoffman, I hear you having be willing after this hearing to have a conversation before it either goes to state and local government, probably would best be discussed in that hearing. And Senator Hayden.
You know what, Madam Chair, I'm going to pass.
Okay, thank you, Senator Hayden. I think that we would have – would you like to have one more crack at this, Ms. York, and then we will go to a closing statement from Senator Hoffman.
I would simply like to point out, Madam Chair, that the question of creep is obvious in Jeremy Miller has not necessarily stated here, but that he is with the Alliance of Massage Therapists for Licensure. And so that is clearly a end game on this.
Thank you. Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. This is a voluntarily registration, and nothing under the provision of 146A will be handed. I will definitely sit down with Senator Nenow and look at how we make sure that the language of voluntary stays in front of us. And I want to thank you for your time, Madam Chair, and I do want to see this moved forward onto the next.
So your motion, Senator Hoffman, would be that this bill be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on State and Local Government, and the bill be considered for inclusion in our omnibus bill.
That's correct, Madam Chair.
As amended.
As amended.
Thank you. Any further discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Nay? Passes. Thank you very much.
Did you want to do your repeat here?
Didn't more people come in?
Can I take this or just send it over to me? Oh, I got one for it.
Moving on to Senate File 2027. Senator Sharon, please go ahead.
Thank you very much. Thank you, committee, for your steadfastness. We have a short session. We have lots of bills that are coming in front of us, so we need to stay focused on the actual content of the bills that are in front of us. And that's my goal tonight, to make certain that everybody knows that the bill that is in front of us is about modifying the definition of smoking for the purposes of the Clean Indoor Air Act to include inhaling and exhaling vapor from any heated cigar, cigarette, or pipe, or any other heated tobacco or plant product or electronic delivery service or device. The definition is also modified to include holding a heated cigar, cigarette, pipe, or electronic delivery device intended for inhalation. It prohibits inhaling or exhaling vapor from an electronic delivery device in a public school. It modifies municipal license requirements of tobacco and tobacco-related devices and similar products. It authorizes a town board and governing body of a home rule charter city, county board, and the State Agricultural Society to license and regulate the retail sales of electronic delivery services and nicotine. It applies to existing administrative penalties to this, as existed in this statute. And let's see what else, if I turn my page, I want to remind everybody of. It authorizes licensing authorities to consult with interested educators, parents, children, and representatives, or the court to develop alternative penalties for minors who purchase and possess electronic delivery services. It requires licensing authorities to conduct unannounced compliance checks at each location where tobacco-related devices or electronic delivery devices are sold. And it extends the affirmative defense that the license or individual making a sale to someone under the age of 18 relied in good faith upon proof of age to the charge of selling electronic delivery devices or nicotine or lobelia delivery products to someone under the age of 18. So the language here specifically restricts the sale of electronic cigarettes to persons under the age of 18. There are other subdivisions here that relate to the penalties associated with this that are similar and simply apply the same standards to the utilization of e-cigarettes in public places or the sale of the electronic devices to minors, as is held in the Freedom to Breathe Act. I think that I'll just step away from reading through the detail of this. I know that our Commissioner of Health wants to address this issue, but I want to narrow and be clear about what it is that we're talking about in this bill and what we are not talking about, so that the testimony that you hear is related to the subject of this bill and not to some other subject that people may be concerned about. And that is that there is nothing in this bill that prohibits a person from purchasing e-cigarettes unless they're under the age of 18. There's nothing in here that prohibits a person who wants to choose this as a method for attempting to reduce their tobacco utilization while sustaining an addiction to nicotine. If they choose to do that, that's an adult person's choice to do that. There's nothing that puts a ban on e-cigarettes if a person chooses to go and use it within their own space or take the risk into their own person. What this does do is limit the sale of this to minors, and it also says that although you are permitted and continue to be able to purchase this, and that if you choose to make a risk in your life about utilizing this product at this time, that the public does not share that risk with you, and the legislation sets a limitation by requiring that in enclosed social spaces and indoor air, that remain a place where e-cigarettes cannot be used. It does not prohibit the person from using alternatives that are authorized already and demonstrated by research to have a demonstrated capacity to help reduce dependency on nicotine, such as a nicotine patch. So when a person is in an enclosed space or in meetings like this or socializing in a restaurant with their family members and they feel as though they need to address their addiction, they can use that through other FDA-approved approaches for dealing with nicotine dependence. So let me be clear that this language is very narrow. It does not prohibit, does not ban the sale of e-cigarettes, does not stop adult persons from being able to utilize e-cigarettes should they choose to do that. As long as the risk is their own, and if the only ban or restriction that exists here is the sale to minors, and also to not ask the public to take the risk or share the risk of utilizing e-cigarettes with the person who is using it. So with that, clarity, because I think that it's important that we not go off the subject onto other issues that are not relevant to the bill. I'm hoping we maintain that order this evening. I would like to defer to our Commissioner of Health.
Commissioner Ellinger, please introduce yourself for the record.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Ed Ellinger, Commissioner of Health, and I appreciate the opportunity to come and talk with you in support of Senate File 2027. This year we're celebrating the 50th anniversary of the Surgeon General's report on smoking and health. And I'm old enough to have been around during that time and saw that up until that time we had lots of information about the hazards of tobacco use, but it was challenged over and over and over again. And it wasn't until 1964 when we really had enough evidence to really say unequivocally this is a major problem for the health of our society. The problem with the fact that we waited so long to start to regulate tobacco at that point in time was that at that point, 50%, over 50% of males were smoking, and we had large businesses related to tobacco, and it was part of our culture, and we've been trying to catch up ever since. We have certainly made a lot of progress, and particularly we made a lot of progress since 2007 when the Freedom to Breathe Act came about, because that was an effective way, by not having tobacco used in public spaces, that we were able to really start to even get more progress on reducing tobacco use in our society. But the tobacco industry has continued, and others who benefit from getting people addicted to nicotine have really tried to find other ways by having smokeless tobacco. And e-cigarettes is one of those things that came about as a way to try to get around some of these effective measures of controlling the use of products that have nicotine. And they're using some of the same tactics to get them before us that they used before 1964 about demanding certainty for some of the research about the harms without producing any of the certainty about the safety of the products. So we are in the process now with trying to get e-cigarettes under the Freedom to Breathe Act, because they really, by having them out of public view for children and exposure to others, we can really continue to really work on getting tobacco and nicotine addiction out of our society. Currently, despite the fact that e-cigarettes are an effective delivery device for a very powerful drug, e-cigarettes are not regulated right now by FDA or by anybody. There are over 300 manufacturers of e-cigarettes with no regulations, no consistency in the quality. Labeling has been inconsistent and sometimes completely inaccurate. The quality control processes for producing e-cigarettes are very limited and vary quite a bit, sometimes even put together in the shops themselves at a local level. The potential risks of e-cigarettes remain undetermined. However, we know about carcinogens and toxins that have been found in e-cigarettes, several that are also in conventional cigarettes. The vapor produced by e-cigarettes has not been proven to be safe, and some studies have shown some toxins in that e-cigarettes. And without proper regulation, it's difficult to know how much nicotine or what other products, potentially harmful cancer-causing chemicals, are exposing people during their use. And I'm particularly concerned as a pediatrician about the fact that e-cigarettes are being used by children. And in fact, the CDC has demonstrated that the use of e-cigarettes by 11th and 12th graders has doubled in the last year or so. It's not surprising, because they're using flavors that are very appealing to children. They're also using marketing techniques that have been shown to really be effective with children. So we know that they're being marketed to children, and none of us really want children to be addicted to nicotine. And sometimes they're being altered as a safer alternative to tobacco users or to tobacco use, but we don't have that kind of information. And we know that young people are really, really vulnerable to the social and environmental components. That's why having e-cigarettes not available in public spaces where they get socialized, get normalized, get glamorized, will be one way of keeping kids from becoming, keep them from becoming addicted. Also, the e-cigarettes are sometimes touted as a way of helping people stop smoking. They certainly can be used, as the senator has mentioned, in their own way, in your own home and in your own circumstances, but not in public places. And there's no body of evidence, actually, that proves that e-cigarettes help people stop smoking. There are FDA-approved mechanisms that are known to work and that have been regulated by FDA, and those are there. And sometimes, though, the use of e-cigarettes actually might actually keep people from quitting, because people do dual use, using e-cigarettes when they can't use regular cigarettes, and that keeps them from quitting, and that keeps us from actually reducing the harms caused by tobacco. So I think the state has a responsibility to act. E-cigarette use, which mimic conventional cigarettes in smoke-free areas, undermine the significance of the Freedom to Breathe Act, which was a really powerful public health law that was put on the books. There is no known evidence to show that the vapor emitted from e-cigarettes is safe. We need to minimize the risk of unregulated products that pose these unknown risks, health risks in particular. E-cigarettes may complicate enforcement of smoke-free laws, as it may be difficult to distinguish them from conventional cigarettes. E-cigarette use in smoke-free areas make the Clean Indoor Air Act less effective at keeping children and families free from the exposure of nicotine and other potentially harmful cancer-causing chemicals. And e-cigarettes may undermine the efforts to encourage people to quit because of the dual use that I talked about. Sustaining conventional tobacco use by using e-cigarettes oftentimes does keep people from quitting. So I think including the use of e-cigarettes under the Freedom to Breathe Act will make the smoke-free laws easier to enforce, and we will be a public health benefit to adults, but particularly the children, where we don't know if they become addicted to nicotine, if they'll go on to tobacco use, but no one wants any our children to become addicted to nicotine. And with the marked increase in use of e-cigarettes by youth, that is a major concern. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Commissioner. And now moving to, is it Janelle Waldock?
It is.
Please introduce yourself for the record.
Yes. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I appreciate the opportunity to be here to testify in favor of Senate File 2027. My name is Janelle Waldock, and I'm the director of the Center for Prevention at Blue Cross and Blue Shield of Minnesota. I'm appearing before the committee today on behalf of a coalition of health organizations that have all gotten behind this legislation. They include the American Cancer Society, the American Heart Association, the American Lung Association, the Association for Nonsmokers Minnesota, Blue Cross and Blue Shield of Minnesota, Clearway Minnesota, the Minnesota Medical Association, and many others. I'm also a veteran of the fight to pass the Freedom to Breathe Act in 2007, and because of your leadership in this room, it was a success. It can be hard to remember the controversy that once surrounded that law or just how many years that it took to pass. The reason that it's so hard to remember is because today, the Freedom to Breathe Act is one of the most popular policies our state has ever passed. In fact, every survey conducted since 2007 has found it growing even more popular, with the most recent poll conducted just last month showing that 87% of people in Minnesota approve of that law. That's an incredibly strong nod of support from people throughout the state. Other studies demonstrate the positive health impacts of the law. After its implementation, the University of Minnesota tested hospitality workers for tobacco-related carcinogens and found an 85% reduction. An 85% reduction. That's incredible. The Mayo Clinic also found a substantial decrease in heart attacks. Additional studies demonstrate decreases in secondhand smoke exposure, as well as more people, including smokers, voluntarily making their homes smoke-free. All of these studies underscore why the Freedom to Breathe Act was a good idea in the first place. It's essential that we protect the integrity of the law and the clean air that Minnesotans have come to expect and support. In fact, Minnesotans overwhelmingly agree that e-cigarettes should be included in the law's language. In a poll conducted again just last month, 79% of Minnesotans said that they support prohibiting e-cigarette use in places where smoking is already prohibited. An even larger number, 87%, support keeping e-cigarettes behind the counter in stores, a provision that is also included in Senator Sharon's bill. The legislature can correct this loophole by taking a common sense approach. Support the legislation that is in front of you today. Our state has enjoyed clean indoor air for 7 years, and Minnesotans have responded. This is what they want. Let's not go backwards. Thank you for your consideration.
Thank you very much for your testimony.
Senator Wicklund.
We can take a question if you wish.
I just wanted to draw attention to the remarks about the public support for maintaining and protecting the rights of persons who choose to use e-cigarettes as long as it's not in indoor places. And that I think that's an important message here. I want to continue to repeat that we're not about restricting people's access to e-cigarettes. We're restricting it in a way that it does not share the risk with the general public. That polling results is in the materials that were presented to members of the committee if you want to see those. And then I was just trying to get people to pay attention to the order so that people free up the chairs and let the other testifiers move forward.
So we'll take a question. Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And this question is directed to Ms. Waldock. You mentioned the 85% reduction in carcinogens, and there's 87% that approve of the Freedom to Breathe Act. Do you have a dollar figure on how much in cost savings, health care savings, our Freedom to Breathe Act has shown to date?
You know, Madam Chair, Senator Rosen, I wish that I did, but I don't have that data. I don't know that anybody has done a study that kind of correlates the cost savings that have come from the law. But we know that the health benefits have been substantial. Again, a major reduction in heart attacks that's been proven by the Mayo Clinic. And then, again, this University of Minnesota study that shows the number of carcinogens and hospitality workers going down significantly. So, I mean, from our perspective, it's easy, even without the specific data to show cost savings, to be able to connect the dots, that those are that this law has resulted in fewer people getting sick from exposure to secondhand smoke, and ultimately that's going to have a positive impact on our healthcare system and cost.
Madam Chair.
Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It would be interesting to, I know New York has put a figure to, and I could be wrong, but I think it was New York has put a figure to their,
yep,
to their savings. So if,
yeah,
if at some point we can round up some figures, that'd be great. I know that's kind of a monumental task, but I can bet that's it's substantial.
I think that you're right about that. Thanks, Senator.
Thank you. Any additional questions?
Madam Chair.
Senator
to
Hillary?
That point, I mean, we do have some data. I mean, from our, the tobacco tax, the health impact fee, we did do a set of reports. The first thing was to pay to DHS somehow to pay for the tobacco-related costs on our healthcare system, and we always greatly exceeded the total amount of the tax collected. I don't remember all of the details from that report, but that tobacco-related cost does exist in order to allocate the tobacco tax, the health impact fee, mm-hmm, such as it were, and it was. I think they kind of quit estimating. They said it's way more than the tax collected.
Madam Chair.
Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, Senator Lurie, it's always hard to put a dollar amount to a prevention measure.
Right.
And that's exactly what this is a prevention measure.
Any other questions? Thank you. And then let's move to the next testifier is Pat McCone. Please introduce yourself. And
thank you. My name is Pat McCone. I'm the Director of Tobacco Control Programs and Policy for the American Lung Association of the Upper Midwest, and I'm based out of Duluth. I do take note, Senator Lurie, that it was Moose Lake in your area that passed the first policy for smoke-free air, and it was a very controversial issue at that time, and look at what's happened since then. And Senator Sharon, for your leadership on freedom to breathe. So I'm a grandma, and when my grandson and I are building something and something goes wrong, I'll say, Will, we've got a situation. And he'll say, Grandma, why do you say we have a situation? And then I'll explain why. Well, I'm here to tell you we have a situation. The bill before you is not a ban on e-cigarettes, and I'm glad Senator Sharon made that abundantly clear. This is common sense regulation, which would simply limit where these unregulated devices and their unregulated contents can be spewed into public air. Use of them in private homes or outdoors, just like current cigarette smoke, would not change. Nor would it change the practice of sampling or use in tobacco stores as defined by Freedom to Breathe. I'm proud to say that we have led many of the efforts at the local level. In my home base of Duluth, Minnesota, we've already passed this legislation. I can tell you the e-cigarette stores there themselves have posted very openly that they're doing just fine. I want to talk a little bit about background here. The FDA tried to regulate these devices as nicotine delivery devices, and they were sued by the tobacco industry, saying we are not cessation devices and we don't want to be treated that way. And they won their lawsuit in court. So anything you hear tonight about cessation, you can't have it both ways. If you sue and say you're not this, you can't be that. Any debate about cessation is really not relevant to this discussion tonight. We are merely asking for the public's right to breathe clean air to be respected, and that these devices and their unknown chemicals be used outside. You will also hear today that these are safer than regular cigarettes. And that's always interesting to me, because safer than the only known consumer product and used as directed will kill you really doesn't equal safe. These products and their contents are not regulated. It is the Wild West out there. In a recent study, 35 brands of e-cigarettes were tested for what they said they contained. 7 actually contained the levels of nicotine as stated. seven contained more, 10 contained the amount stated, and 18 contained less. This can be expected when a product is not regulated and it's brewed by amateurs in strip malls, in basements, or they could even be mixed in the trunk of a car. And I am also concerned. Last week I received a copy of an email from a sheriff in one of our small rural communities saying, for the first time, he had experienced somebody coming into probation testing positive for meth. He had a vaporizer e-cigarette on him, and he told the probation officer that he was smoking meth with the vaporizer. I hear this concern a lot in greater Minnesota, and it really became very much a concern in Duluth as we were dealing with the issue of synthetic marijuana. So, you know, that's just another way that these devices are out there and being used and misused. Proponents will tell you that the vapors are simple emissions, are water vapor, and the truth is that the following ingredients have been found in secondhand emissions: nicotine, one of the most addictive drugs we know, propylene glycol, which is a known respiratory irritant, tin particles, aluminum, iron, nickel, arsenic, copper, lead, carcinogenic compounds, and volatile organic compounds. Clearly, these are far from harmless water vapor. Some emissions have been found to contain more metals than in cigarettes themselves. Again, most are not found in quantities like regular cigarettes, but smaller amounts. But smaller than the most deadly is not safe. So let's talk a little bit about our concern to marketing to kids. Can't go many places these days without my Hello Kitty e-cigarette. One of my staff purchased this in an e-cigarette store. She was over 18. But to see a device like this around my grandchildren and your grandchildren or children, how do you explain, that's okay, that's no big deal, that's a Hello Kitty cigarette? And how do we get by with lemon, blueberry, cotton candy, e-juice? Now, I wear glasses, but I can dare you to read the warning on this label. It's almost illegible. It is so small. An interesting flavor, I would say, targeted at children. A recent CDC study confirmed that, with doubling of the use among middle school children. With so much debate and science needed on this topic, the public health decision must be made on the precautionary principle, the do no harm, kind of what I call the berry picking principle. If you're out in the woods and you see a berry and you don't know what it is, you don't eat it till you find out. Okay, we're not going to breathe it until we find out more. And I really want to talk about big tobacco. And I brought some of the ads because marketing a new product is challenging, and a new product such as e-cigarettes. A regular e-cigarette, it's like this, hard to tell. We called many business owners in the city of Duluth asking them what their policy was. 18 out of 20 agreed they want it regulated. They do not want their servers trying to find out, is that a regular cigarette? Is it an e-cigarette? So let's talk about some of the cigarette ads and who's giving the advice. Jenny McCarthy. It is freedom to have a cigarette without the guilt. Okay. For all smokers, we're introducing them to the new generation of smoking. Not going to take this small one. But I do want to show and save this for last, and I warned our student in the audience about this, that these racketeers, these convicted racketeers, Laura Lard, Philip Morris, and R.J. Reynolds, are the e-cigarette industry. And their real message is about normalizing this behavior back in public. You know, I talk to kids today and say, do you know they used to have smoking on airplanes? And they go, really? Do we want smoking back in bars and restaurants? Do we want them back in our workplace? Well, here's what the cigarette industry feels like. This is a paid ad by Blue Cigarettes about what they feel about our smoke-free law. So with that, I would like to introduce Carissa Ontiveros, who is a student and would like to talk about her experience.
Thank you, and please introduce yourself for the record.
Carissa Ontiveros, and I'll go on.
And go ahead, yes.
Good evening, committee chair, members of the committee. My name is Carissa Ontiveros. I currently live at 759 Sims, St. Paul, Minnesota, 55106. I'm a 2011 graduate of Johnson High School and a lifelong resident of the east side of St. Paul. I'm a first-generation college student at Hamline University and here representing Latino Youth Advocates for Education, Health, and Social Justice, formerly known as Jóvenes de Salud. I have been a Latina youth advocate since the sixth grade, advocating for healthy and safe communities in St. Paul, especially in St. Paul public schools, such as Johnson and Harding High School. I'm here today because I feel strongly that e-cigarettes should be regulated like all other tobacco products. In 2010, Sonia Navarro, a fellow Jóvenes member and a student from Harding High School, was dismissed when she complained about a classmate smoking an e-cigarette in the classroom. The student using the e-cigarette was not disciplined, but Sonia was simply due to the fact that she felt strongly in tobacco-free classrooms. The teacher was dismissing the fact that classrooms should be healthy and safe for all students. In 2012, Jóvenes de Salud students from Harding and Johnson High School testified before the St. Paul School Board, successfully seeking their support in treating e-cigarettes as tobacco products in the school policy. About a fifth of school districts across Minnesota have updated their policy treating e-cigarettes like all other tobacco products. Tonight, I, along with the Latino Youth Advocates for Education, Health, and Social Justice and Association for Non-Smokers Minnesota, are here seeking your support for a tobacco-free environment for all public schools across Minnesota. We fully support all of Senate File 2027, especially Section 2, regulating e-cigarettes is extremely important to me and the Latino youth advocates, some of which are here, knowing that the tobacco industry continues to target us with their deadly products. It's time for our voices to be heard so we don't lose another loved one to tobacco. Thank you.
Thank you very much for coming tonight and testifying for us. Members, do you have any questions for the testifiers at the table? Okay, thank you very much. The next person on the list is Ann Joseph, Dr. Ann Joseph. If you could please state your name for the record.
Sure. Good evening, Madam Chair and members of the committee. Thank you for the opportunity to speak with you tonight. My name is Ann Joseph. I'm a physician investigator and professor of medicine at the University of Minnesota Medical School. I'm also past president of the Society for Research on Nicotine and Tobacco, which is the world's leading organization for research on nicotine. I'm here to lend strong support to Senate File 2027. E-cigarettes have only been available in the United States since 2007. There have, therefore, been only a few years to develop a scientific knowledge base about e-cigarettes and their effects. Since the products are unregulated and rapidly changing, the existing evidence is far from conclusive, and many important research questions remain. So I feel that there are many reasons to be cautious about policies regarding electronic cigarettes. Advocates say that they are harmless, but there's simply not enough information yet to support that claim. Initial studies confirm that there are heavy metals, as you've heard, nicotine, carcinogens, and other toxic compounds in the vapor, although in lower concentrations than combusted cigarettes. There have been no long-term studies of electronic cigarettes, so we don't know the lasting effects on users or those exposed to secondhand vapor. The most important thing, I think, is that we don't know yet the effect of electronic cigarettes on the use of regular cigarettes. Recent data confirm that the majority of electronic cigarette users are dual users, meaning they use both electronic cigarettes and combustible tobacco products, which we know are deadly. I fully support everyone who has stopped using cigarettes, but so far there are insufficient data to show that electronic cigarettes are effective for quitting. In fact, the initial studies suggest that they're not effective. The FDA has not approved them for smoking cessation, and there are no best practices or treatment protocols to use them to help smokers quit. Another concern is the investment the tobacco industry has made in e-cigarettes. This is worrisome, as we know they have zero interest in moving smokers away from nicotine. Nicotine, which is common to both e-cigarettes and deadly tobacco, is a very addictive drug. E-cigarettes, particularly the new designs, may perpetuate nicotine dependence or establish it in non-smokers. E-cigarettes are not regulated as a tobacco product, and they're not regulated as a medication. This loophole means that the law does not require disclosure of ingredients, and it's not possible to know what chemicals individual liquids contain or the amounts. Manufacturers are often small operations with no oversight or public accountability. The potential for accidents is very high. In 2013, the Hennepin Regional Poison Center saw an 8-fold increase in calls related to e-cigarette use, and half of the calls were in regards to children less than 5 years old. These numbers are mirrored in national statistics. A great concern is their appeal to youth. E-cigarettes have cotton candy flavors, gummy bear, and others, and research shows flavored tobacco has a strong appeal for children and teens. Use by kids has risen, and as Dr. Ellinger explained, CDC recently reported teenager use doubling between 2011 and 12. Children need to be protected from products containing tobacco or nicotine, given the risks of lifelong addiction. We need to remember the big picture. You've heard about the 50th anniversary of the Surgeon General's report on smoking, and it has taken at least 50 years of work to bring the smoking rate down. From 42% nationally to 18% nationwide, and it's now 16% in the state of Minnesota. Science shows that smoking cessation and restricting smoking in public played a large part in that success. This has resulted in dramatic decreases in heart disease, COPD, and lung cancer, one of the deadliest of cancers. As a practicing physician, I can attest to those decreases. The reduction in smoking-related disease is one of our major accomplishments, and we don't know yet if e-cigarettes will help or threaten that remarkable progress by undermining smoke-free ordinances. Until we know they help, we can't afford the risk of lowering quit rates or prolonging smoking. Therefore, I strongly support these proposals. Thank you, and I'd be happy to take questions if there are any.
Thank you, Dr. Joseph. Does anybody have any questions for Dr. Joseph? No? Okay. Then we'll move on to, I believe, to the testifiers in opposition to the bill. I'd like to call Greg Connolly and Chris Tipton to the table. Please state your name and introduce yourself to the committee.
Good evening. My name is Chris Tipton. I was a pack-a-day smoker of traditional tobacco cigarettes for about 10 years, and I've been smoke-free for over 3 years thanks to electronic cigarettes. Using an electronic cigarette has been a huge positive impact on my life. When I was regularly smoking tobacco cigarettes, I could feel the damage I was doing to my body. This included terrible coughing spells, dulled senses of taste and smell, and running out of breath just going up a flight of stairs. I didn't care about my health because I knew that I was already killing myself with tobacco cigarettes. But all of this changed when I started using electronic cigarettes. My cough has completely vanished. My doctor has told me that my lung function has returned to the level of a non-smoker. Foods taste the way they're supposed to again, and I can work out without immediately running out of breath. I care more about my health in general, and as an added bonus, I don't smell like an ashtray. Since I made the switch, I've also helped several friends and family members do the same. All of them have experienced similar results. In addition to the changes I have made for myself, exactly 1 year ago today, I got engaged to my lovely fiance, Alyssa, and Alyssa has told me on several occasions that she would have never even started dating me if I was still smoking, and I can't blame her. Today, I am happy to call myself a smoke-free person, but it wasn't easy to get to this point. I had tried to quit several times before, using the more traditional methods, without any success. I am proof that electronic cigarettes can change lives for the better. Without them, I am certain I would still be smoking tobacco cigarettes. I would be much less healthy, and I wouldn't have a wedding coming up in just a few months. I've heard the arguments made from those who wish to see these devices subjected to an indoor use ban. The problem is every argument they bring up is tragically flawed. Not enough studies? This isn't true. There are several studies available for those who aren't afraid of the results. I encourage you to check out mnvapors.com or casaa.org to learn more about the studies that have been done. Spoiler, no peer-reviewed scientific study to date has shown electronic cigarettes to cause any risk to bystanders. heard that they're a gateway to traditional cigarettes, and actually they're a gateway away from them, as my story and several of my friends and family and those in attendance can attest to. We've heard that they're marketing to children. I mean, if making candy flavors means that they're marketing to children, then someone better let the alcohol industry know, because currently there's a vodka company that makes flavors like cake and candy bar, and nobody is going after them. I use sweet flavors myself because I like them, and they help keep me away from tobacco cigarettes. So we should be encouraging people to make the switch to electronic cigarettes so more people can experience the benefits that my friends, family members, and I have had. We shouldn't be banning something, even indoors, when the studies are showing that it poses no risk to users or bystanders. An indoor use ban on electronic cigarettes sends the signal that they are just as bad for people as tobacco cigarettes. This will discourage others from switching to this healthier alternative. An indoor use ban would also cause harm for the vapors themselves, as we would ultimately be forced outside with the tobacco cigarette smokers and left to inhale their secondhand smoke, and with that, the same toxins and carcinogens that we successfully got away from. In addition, an indoor use ban would seriously hinder a vape shop's ability to do business effectively. Most smokers are not going to want to drop $70 to $100 on a product they don't know if they will like because they weren't able to try it beforehand. In conclusion, I just want to say that I am not a smoker. I am an ex-smoker, and vaping is not smoking, and it should not be treated as such. So I urge you to remove Section 1 from Senate File 2027, and with that, the indoor use ban. Thank you for your time, and we have a subject matter expert, Mr. Conley, who will be happy to answer any questions. However, if you do have any questions about my own personal experience, I would be happy to take those at this time.
Thank you, Mr. Tipton. Mr. Connolly, please introduce yourself for the record.
Hi, Chair Wicklund and distinguished members of the Senate Health, Human Services, and Housing Committee. My name is Gregory Connolly. 3.5 years ago, after struggling to quit much of my adult life with the nicotine gum, patch, and lozenge, I quit smoking virtually overnight with a watermelon-flavored electronic cigarette. After having such a positive experience and doing my research, I was shocked to see that so-called anti-smoking advocates were out urging state governments to ban the sale of electronic cigarettes to adults, a tactic they have thankfully backed away from now, and were trying to get them to ban usage wherever smoking is banned by deceitfully redefining smoking. I began intensely studying the issue, and not long after came to the conclusion that these groups' opposition to electronic cigarettes by adult smokers was a true public health problem that needed to be addressed. From there, I spent approximately 3 years as the volunteer legislative director for CASA, the Consumer Advocates for Smoke-Free Alternatives Association, a nonprofit that represents the interests of consumers of vapor products and electronic cigarettes. In November, I left that post, and I am now a research fellow with the Heartland Institute, a free market think tank based in Chicago. I'd like to thank Senator Benson for inviting Heartland to participate in this important hearing. Heartland is in agreement with many in the public health field that electronic cigarettes represent our best hope to get millions of American smokers to quit inhaling burning smoke into their lungs on a daily basis. Every month, as the scientific literature grows, supporting electronic cigarettes as likely being 98 to 99% less hazardous than smoking, the support for harm reduction policies among public health advocates and even some in tobacco control grows as well. Indeed, in January, the staunchly anti-tobacco Dr. David Abrams of the Legacy Institute, which used to run those very graphic anti-smoking truth campaign commercials, you may recall, penned an editorial in the Journal of the American Medical Association entitled, "Can Disruptive Technology Make Cigarettes Obsolete?" Dr. Abrams and many others believe that the answer to that question is a resounding yes. These public health advocates supporting e-cigarettes are almost universally extremely strong proponents of smoking bans. But because e-cigarettes do not create smoke and have never been shown to emit any level of any hazardous chemical that would be harmful to bystanders, they do not support banning uses where smoking's banned. Indeed, Dr. Abrams just a couple months ago was in New York City for a conference, and he spoke and said that electronic cigarettes should not be subject to tobacco sin taxes, and they shouldn't be subject to smoking bans as a way of voluntarily nudging smokers towards quitting. Indeed, Wisconsin and Tennessee are both following this approach, as two Wisconsin bills will be heard this week to formally clarify that electronic cigarettes are not subject to Wisconsin's smoking ban. Now, I heard many of the comments here today, and I watched last week's hearing. As a preliminary matter, it's important to understand that clean indoor air is not the standard under which Minnesota operates. Yes, clean indoor air is how we generally refer to a bill that bans smoking in most indoor areas. But as you all know, it is the content of the bill and not its pithy nickname that matters. Instead, smoke-free air is the standard that Minnesotans live under and deserve. As far as I know, none of the speakers today have urged you to use the Freedom to Breathe Act to regulate nail salons or mechanics, both of which are recognized by the EPA as putting hazardous chemicals into indoor air. Instead, the state of Minnesota wisely leaves these standards to federal agencies like OSHA. And by the way, no study has ever shown levels of chemicals emitted from vapor products that would violate OSHA standards. Second, numerous speakers have made reference to scary-sounding chemicals that have been detected in e-cigarette liquid or vapor. Critically, they fail to note the actual levels of these chemicals found. In doing so, they have failed to adhere to a central tenet of toxicology: the dose makes the poison. For example, FDA testing in 2009 found trace levels of tobacco-specific nitrosamines, which are carcinogens at high amounts. Presenters in states across the nation have not disclosed that these chemicals, one, are naturally present at trace tiny levels in all smoke-free nicotine products, including the gum, patch, and inhaler, and two, that these chemicals have never been detected in e-cigarette vapor. Others noted, a University of California study found that e-cigarette vapor contains metals, which implies that e-cigarette vapor is a source of inhaled toxic metals. Without proper context, presentation of this meeting, this information is extremely misleading. Dr. Michael Siegel, a longtime anti-tobacco advocate who testified against tobacco companies in lawsuits that cost the industry billions, has noted that the daily exposure permitted by the authoritative U.S. Pharmacopeial Convention, USP, for inhalable medications, these levels that were found when you go to the average daily use for an e-cigarette user, they are far less than the standards that medicines operate under for metals. Indeed, Dr. Siegel compared the levels of metals expected to be inhaled by the average e-cigarette user to the average user of a Nicorette inhaler and found that the levels were strikingly similar. And for some metals, the Nicorette inhaler users, the product endorsed by the FDA, actually exposes the user to more trace non-harmful levels of metals. Additionally, because there is not enough time today to go through every study that has been twisted to fit the agenda of activists, I'd like to bring your attention to two critical indoor air studies. First, the respected medical journal BMC Public Health just published a study by Drexel University professor and toxicologist Dr. Igor Burstyn entitled Peering Through the Mist. Dr. Burstyn utilized over 9,000 observations of e-cigarette liquid and vapor in order to assess possible threats to bystanders. With regard to these bystanders, Dr. Burstyn concluded that the levels of chemicals in e-cigarette vapor are so low as to pose no apparent risk. Despite the fact that this study was peer-reviewed and published in a well-regarded journal, some activists have tried to discount it by noting that CASA, the group I used to be legislative director for, funded it. But that was through donations by consumers who are so interested in the science on e-cigarettes that they're willing to fund it themselves. And while it's clear that people who resort to arguments like that are never going to be convinced that e-cigarette vapor does not pose a threat to bystanders, it's worth noting that the findings of the Drexel University study are backed up by several others. For example, the journal Tobacco Control published an excellent study around a year ago that was funded in part by the National Institutes of Health. So it's hard to really attack the funding source. That study tested 12 different e-cigarettes versus a traditional combustible cigarette versus the Nicorette inhaler, FDA approved. That study found that versus the cigarette, e-cigarette vapor contained 9 to 450 times less toxicants and chemicals than in cigarette smoke. And many of those chemicals, many of the levels of those chemicals, virtually all of them, were very similar to what is released from the Nicorette inhaler. Lastly, as I'm from New Jersey, one of the two states that the state legislature has banned e-cigarette use, and one of the three states where e-cigarette use is banned, Utah, North Dakota, and New Jersey. I am from New Jersey, and I can confidently tell you, you will never enforce this law, because e-cigarette users, as I've demonstrated in many places, if they inhale and they simply hold their breath for 4 or 5 seconds and exhale, nothing is released. There's a reason why people are able to use an e-cigarette on a plane and not be detected. Heck, someone could have used an e-cigarette in the back of this room today, and no one would have known. Unfortunately, many non-users of electronic cigarettes, aka adult smokers, are not aware of this. So when I arrived in Minnesota yesterday, it was negative 13 degrees out. So if you're a hardcore smoker and you have that incentive to switch taken away, you have to go outside in the cold. If you have to suffer through 4 or 5 minutes of bone-chilling cold, are you really going to choose a healthy alternative, healthier alternative, or are you just going to smoke a cigarette? I think we all know that smokers will smoke, and that being able to use an e-cigarette indoors provides an incentive not to smoke. In conclusion, e-cigarette usage bans have no basis in toxicology. No study has shown any level of any chemical that could be harmful to bystanders. Instead of spending time on ineffective measures like banning their use where smoking is banned, states should instead study electronic cigarettes and how increasing use of the product is creating and will continue to create ex-smokers, which is a benefit for all of public health in Minnesota. And I thank you for your time, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Are there any questions for either of the testifiers at the table this time? I guess not. No questions. We'll move on. We have three more testifiers listed. Jim Rain and Cap O'Rourke are the next two listed. Mr. Rain, please introduce yourself and state your name for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chairman, Vice Chairman, distinguished members of the Senate Health and Human Service Housing Committee. My name is James Rains. I'm from Big Lake, Minnesota. I'm a professional senior program leader in charge of developing senior experience managers, prepping them for their steps into the executive business leadership for a Fortune 100 multinational company. I don't state this for accolades, but I state this to talk about my professional capabilities and my professional experience. I've been vaping for almost a year after smoking combustible tobacco products for over 30 years. I had my first exposure to the use of combustible tobacco products in 1966. Yes, I was 6 years old. And since I have started vaping, I have not had a single tobacco product. My wife vapes, and she no longer smokes any tobacco after a very long pack per day habit. I've performed literally hundreds and hundreds of hours of research into the positive effects of vaping. I regard e-cigarettes, after my study, and e-cigarette use as potentially the strongest form of tobacco harm reduction ever invented. In fact, an article yesterday was reported in the London Times, which stated that we could save over 105,000 lives per year in the EU alone by the expanded use of electronic cigarettes. I would imagine that number in the United States would be similar, if not more. We've heard lots of testimony today, and I would like to talk about recent testimony by Dr. Ann Joseph. Last week, from the University of Minnesota to the House on HF 1931, along with similar testimony tonight from SF, from your bill, SF 2027. I do want to thank her for her testimony stating, which she didn't say tonight, that vapers were not smokers. We're not smoking cigarettes. And the real enemy is combustible tobacco, not e-cigarettes. She also made the statement, and we heard from the health commissioner, and we've heard often, that nicotine is a carcinogen. She also made the statement that nicotine is not carcinogenic. Thank you, Dr. Joseph. Nicotine, we know, is addictive, but in small doses, such as an e-cigarette, it's a mild stimulant, scientifically proven to be of no greater addiction or danger than caffeine. In fact, I just learned this weekend from a Russian medical doctor friend of mine that nicotine can actually prevent or treat Alzheimer's. However, she and others tonight have said some things that were there's some serious errors in their discussion and their testimony. She stated that we do not know what is in the e-cigarettes, in the liquid. We do. Propylene glycol, vegetable glycerin, distilled water, flavors, and sometimes pharmaceutical-grade liquid nicotine, all components generally recognized as safe by the FDA. We also know what is not in them. 4,000-plus chemicals from the combustion of tobacco with 69 known carcinogens. We also know that there's propylene glycol. Propylene glycol has been studied with long-term studies since the 1940s. It's been routinely used in mistents for cystic fibrosis patients so they can breathe. It's been routinely used as an aerosol bacteria killer in hospital air systems. We have studies from the 40s that talk about the injection into a cage of mice of propylene glycol. They injected the flu vaccine with no propylene glycol. All the mice died. They injected the propylene glycol with the flu vaccine. They all lived. This goes all the way back to old studies from the 1940s. I'd like to speak about one more study very quickly. We heard that we can't talk about smoking cessation. We have this wonderful device, and if I can pull one out, I'm going to show, that can't be mistaken for a cigarette. We have this wonderful device that has a battery and has some e-liquid, and has the wonderful side effect of helping people quit smoking. Dr. Constantino Farsalinos reported that he completed a worldwide survey last year, and it has been thoroughly analyzed. The manuscript has been written, has been submitted for publication in a peer-reviewed medical journal. The study involved analysis of 19,411 participants from all over the world, including 88 participants who were not smokers at the time of the e-cigarette use initiation. To give you an idea about the results, he said 81% reported they had completely substituted smoking with e-cigarette use, while the rest reduced cigarette consumption from a median of 20 to 4 cigarettes per day. We all know that each cigarette takes away 7 minutes of our life. My wife was smoking a pack of cigarettes a day. She's got a 2.5 hours a day left that I have extra with her for the rest of her life because she's doing this vaping as I am. He knows that because he surveyed e-cigarette users, they may not have the same results on the public that, because the e-cigarette users were active users and they wanted to quit smoking. But he does believe that a survey will enhance our current knowledge about the characteristics of e-cigarette users and will provide valuable information to regulatory authorities. And that study, as I said, is being submitted right now for peer review and publication. I'm proud to be one of those success stories. I would love to go on for hours discussing this. It's my passion. I don't get paid. I'm not. I don't have a B&M. This is my passion because of what I've seen it do to the lives of those around me. Thank you for the opportunity to testify. I look forward to any questions. I would hope from the testimonies here you would strike Section 1, Subdivision 4 from the bill. We do. The vapors in Minnesota do support the age ban, we support the other items, but we do not support the redefining of smoking to include e-cigarettes and vapor from SF 2027. Other than that section, I support the rest. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Raines. Mr. O'Rourke, please introduce yourself for the record.
My name is Cap O'Rourke, and I am here representing the Independent Vaping Retailers Association of Minnesota. IVRM is an association of retailers, manufacturers, and distributors of vaping products all based in Minnesota. They are not tobacco companies. My clients are responsible businessmen and women who believe in providing safe products that are reliable and meet the expectations of their clients. Since the Minnesota legislature passed the Clean Indoor Air Act in 2006, and with the recent increase of tobacco taxes, including those on e-cigarettes and vaping solutions, Minnesotans have searched for alternatives to smoking. After trying many FDA-approved devices such as the patch, the gum, and even some non-approved devices such as acupuncture and hypnosis, Minnesotans are turning to vaping as the one source that is getting them to an alternative choice to cigarettes. While there are still more studies being conducted currently, no study, as Mr. Connolly said, no study has yet to show harmful levels of any chemical or byproduct to the bystanders of people using vaping products. Until the science can show without a doubt that these products are harmful, we should not impose unneeded restrictions on their use in public. The IVRM does not support the sale of vaping solutions or vaping products to anyone under the age of 18. Our retail shops card anyone who look under 30, and we do not allow anyone under the age unless they are coming in with a parent or guardian. Despite some claims, our member manufacturers label all their products with ingredients and levels of nicotine contained. And it should be pointed out to any of you who have concerns about this Wild West that we are in, there is nothing in this bill to assuage your concerns. While there are parts of this bill that our organization could support, as long as the public ban is imposed, we have to oppose this bill. We feel that the Clean Indoor Air Standard created in 2006 was done so with full backing of the scientific community. And to literally force Minnesotans seeking an alternative to cigarettes out into the cold and punish the small businesses that are trying to help them for being not for issues not based on scientific findings but rather on fears and speculation is both short-sighted and ill-advised. We urge you to remove the ban on public on smoking in public or vaping in public so that we can work together to create real and meaningful regulations that can limit access to minors and provide adequate protection for adults using our products.
Thank you. Are there questions for either of the testifiers at the table? No? Okay. Thank you very much. There's one last testifier on the list, Tom Briant. Or Bryant. I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing it correctly. And please state your name and as you introduce yourself.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Tom Bryant. I am the executive director of two trade associations. One is the Minnesota Wholesale Marketers Association, and that's a trade association of tobacco wholesalers here in the state. And the other is the National Association of Tobacco Outlets, which is a national trade association for tobacco stores and convenience stores that sell tobacco products. The associations that I represent do not oppose those provisions of Senate File 2027 that prohibit the sale of electronic cigarettes to minors, require licensing of retailers, or have display restrictions. We support those. We already conform to those kind of regulations for regular tobacco products, and we have no problem supporting those provisions of the bill. There is one provision, though, that we'd like to share our concerns with you, and that's the change in the definition of smoking under the Minnesota Clean Indoor Air Act. Most of the points that I was going to make were just made by Mr. Connolly, so I reiterate those and support those points. So I'm just going to touch on a few things. First, Mr. Connolly referred to the Drexel University School of Public Health study several times. Here's the study. I have a copy as well as copies of the conclusions of the study. I'm just going to quote the couple of sentences that are very important for the purpose of this hearing. The study concluded, quote, "An analysis of current state of knowledge about electronic cigarettes indicates that there is no evidence that vaping produces inhalable exposures to contaminants that would warrant health concerns by the standards that are used to ensure safety in workplaces. Exposures of bystanders are likely to be orders of magnitude less and thus pose no apparent concern." Now, apart from the Drexel University study, other studies are going to be conducted by the FDA. They just last fall announced the creation of 14 tobacco research centers around the country. They're funding that with $53 million for the first year and another $250 million over the next 5 years. And the executive director of the FDA Center for Tobacco Products has indicated that those research centers are going to conduct studies on electronic cigarettes to find out what's in the liquid, if they're harmful or if they're not. Now, also, the FDA has already drafted initial regulations on e-cigarettes. Those are currently under review by the White House Office of Management and Budget. And once approved by the OMB, will then be issued to the public for comment. So the FDA, through its experts and through studies, are doing the scientific research that's necessary to support any sound public policy that would restrict the use of e-cigarettes in public places. When you adopted the Clean Indoor Air Act, there was a sound basis for doing so. You had numerous scientific studies that supported it. You need to wait for that same body of scientific evidence to be created now through the FDA and other scientific organizations in order to support such a restriction on the use of e-cigarettes. So for that reason, we'd ask that Section 1 be removed from the bill, but that we support all other sections. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Thank you for your testimony. Are there any questions for Mr. Bryant? Thank you very much.
Madam Chair, can I leave the copies of the Drexel study for the committee members?
Yeah, is there a page who can come in?
Thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you. Senator Sharon, do you have any further remarks?
I have had a request that Dr. Ann Joseph be allowed to respond to what she believes is a misrepresentation of what she said. And so I'd like to invite her.
Dr. Joseph, would you please approach? And please state your name again for the record.
Madam Chair, my name is Ann Joseph, and I appreciate the opportunity to make this correction to Mr. Rain's statement. And I think the record will show from my testimony last week that my comments about nicotine were specifically that it is not a carcinogen. And I did talk about carcinogens in other tobacco products, but that was a misrepresentation of my testimony.
Okay. Thank you. Members, do you have questions now or comments? Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm not sure who could answer this, but maybe Senator Sharon would know. I just have a quick question and then some comments. How does currently, under current law, how does the health care impact fee or the cigarette tax affect e-cigs?
Senator Sharon.
Thank you, Senator Wicklund. I'm going to tell you what I believe to be true. We probably should have somebody confirm what I'm saying, but they're treated for tax purposes the same as cigarettes.
Currently.
No, I don't think so.
Senator Nelson?
They're taxed the same as cigarettes.
Thank you. All right.
I don't think so.
I'm not sure that that's the case. I hope there's someone who can clarify for us.
Okay.
Please. We get a read on that from Senate Counsel. Excuse me, I guess there's someone here who could speak authoritatively
and
to this.
Please state your name.
Madam Chair Janelle Waldock from Blue Cross Blue Shield of Minnesota. The cigarette tax that went into effect last session also included, that bill included other things that affected the tax rates of other tobacco products, so non-cigarette products, and e-cigarettes were included in that. So they are taxed like other tobacco products, so chew tobacco, things like that, at 95% of the wholesale rate.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Did you have another question?
Yes, just a comment. And actually, I'm really glad to hear that because that removed one of my considerations was that, on the one hand, we do want to discourage smoking. We want to discourage tobacco use. And if, in fact, people are using e-cigarettes instead of their more deadly cousins, I think that's a good idea. And I was concerned that the legislation in front of us here, Senator Sharon, that your bill might add a tax to the e-cigs that was not already taxed. But if they're already taxed as tobacco, then that's kind of a non-issue. So there's a lot to like about this bill. I mean, there's a lot to like about the age ban, no kids under 18. No one mentioned the unannounced compliance checks. I think that's great. The licensing, the public school ban. I think all of those things are things that I would strongly support. I will say there's two pieces that are missing that I don't believe we have a secretary who could take the amendments tonight, so I'll just mention them and hope as this bill goes on, Senator Sharon, that maybe you'd consider them. One thing that I think is missing is a list of ingredients. People deserve to know what it is that they're putting into their bodies. And so it seems to me that we should require accurate. I don't know how most food labels are enforced, but I think it's important that that list of ingredients be there. So those adults over 18 who would choose to use e-cigarettes would know exactly what it is that they're putting into their bodies. And the second thing that I think is missing is the one thing that I think would be so helpful tonight, and that is more study on the actual effects of the e-cigarettes. And I would like to encourage you to, I have an amendment here. I won't offer it tonight, but it just adds after, at the end of the bill, page 7 after line 16, insert section 7, e-cigarette health study. The Commissioner of Health shall study the health effects associated with inhaling the vapor from an electronic delivery device. The Commissioner shall submit the results of the study to the legislature by March 15th, 2015. And I think that's something that we need to see. I want to know more about how e-cigarettes really, what is the impact? We're concerned now. We don't know for sure. And so your bill is erring on the side of, well, let's ban them as, or not let's ban them, excuse me, wrong choice of words. Let's treat them like we do cigarettes in public places under the Clean Indoor Act. I would say that's erring on the side of caution. I would like to get more facts as we go forward on this. And I think it's really imperative that we, especially when it's not exactly clear yet, at least in my mind, if e-cigarettes maybe, I mean, I do know people who have quit smoking and have now smoke e-cigarettes. And I do think that's a positive step for them. And so before we totally make the Clean Indoor Air Act apply to e-cigarettes, I wish we had more information on the table, and that's what I think this study will do. But I will not offer my amendment. I'm just offer it for your consideration as the bill goes forward.
Thank you, Senator Nelson. Senator Sharon, did you have a comment?
I think that I absolutely agree that there are separate questions and issues that need investment research, for example, and a process by which, because these cartridges are not the same, cartridge is not a cartridge is not a cartridge, so doing comparative analysis and research requires that step, which is to define what is in a cartridge, what can be, what the chemical levels are, so then there can be reliable research, comparative research on what people are inhaling and exhaling. So I agree that that is a necessary, another step, maybe another piece of legislation that we should be promoting, including increasing a good, reliable study on what the impacts of e-cigarettes are. Not only, trying to find some legitimacy, the insurance companies would cover the product if we had research to indicate that it reduced smoking. Blues would be very interested in that. And so we should try to get that affirmed. So I agree with the concept. I just want to stay focused today on what the purpose of this bill is, which is to restrict the sales to minors and to establish a process for cities to be able to monitor and encourage compliance with the clean indoor concept by not allowing vaping, the inhale or exhale of this product in public places. And that's really the narrow focus of this, not asking for those things that we really are continuing to have a debate about, the legitimacy of research. We've had our own commissioner come and indicate concern, and also researchers from the University of Minnesota. Dr. Joseph is one of her credentials was that she was the chair of the research for the content for addiction. I'm going to pull it up here quickly to see what her background was. It's very impressive. President of the Society on Research on Nicotine and Tobacco, indicating that we simply cannot assure the public's safety, and that the public is asking us through the polling to not share the risk with those who choose as adults to use this product. And until we are able to do what you're talking about, or that there's more national studies on this, that we continue to support the rights of persons who inhale and exhale this product, not interfering with the right to take the risks based on their own choice, but to set the limit that is indicated in this bill to not ask the general public to share that risk with them.
Thank you. Senator Rosen, you had a question first, then I'll come
back. Thank you, Madam Chair. And first off, I'd like to just congratulate everybody that has been able to quit smoking. And whether you vape or you have just been able to quit smoking. That's the paramount measure here, and you need to be congratulated for that, because I'm sure that is probably one of the most difficult things to do in someone's life. And I do believe that because of the lack of research that we have available, that is why we need to take this measure, as Senator Sharon says, to protect those who are around us, because this is like the unknown area for us. We don't know the health impact going forward, but I'm just looking at some of the websites, and I put in e-cigarette methamphetamine, and it says here, now that e-cigarettes really seem to be taking off, I wonder, has anyone out there ever tried smoking meth or crack an e-cigarette? Smoke meth is all you need to know about smoking meth, and you can do it in an e-cigarette on smokemeth.com. It goes on and on about methamphetamine, and that's a whole different set of websites that are very troubling, And if someone is smoking meth or vaping meth in public, that is a serious issue we have. The other website that I went to was the marijuana one, and there is a pretty good article in the Time magazine about smokers using e-cigarettes to get high. Some marijuana users may see the same benefits of e-cigarettes as smokers. So, I mean, you know, there are so many variables here about what can be used with these e-cigarettes, and we don't have enough information. And I think by allowing the public to be exposed to these possibilities is very, very troubling. And so we're not putting a ban on these. We are actually trying to put them in the same category as tobacco products, which they are taxed as the same amount, and they should be treated the same amount behind the counter and taxed the same way. So I'm just a little perplexed at where we're going, but I do feel that if we can eliminate smoking, that's great. But I do remember a good friend of mine, he quit smoking, and then I saw him smoking a cigar, and he goes, well, this isn't smoking. So I'm a little, you know, confused there.
Thank you. Senator Nelson, did you still have a question or comment? No? Okay. Are there other questions? Senator Nino.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Sharon, when I first read the bill, looked through it, 90% of it's great. You know, there's one little piece that I wasn't comfortable with. And then hearing the testimony here from all the opposition, it seems like you're this close to one of those kumbaya bills, but for Section 1. All the rest of this makes a lot of sense, and it's things I've thought about in the past as well. Basically, we're looking at trying to restrict access to minors. It really is what a lot of the gist is of the rest of your bill, as I read it anyway. And whereas right now it's completely legal, and theoretically anyway, except for self-regulation by the retailers, is completely available, and that would eliminate that. And when we're talking about a highly addictive substance, I think that's a legitimate restriction to put into law. That once you're an adult, you can decide if you want to engage in inhaling an addictive substance of this sort that's a legal product, but we should probably restrict that to the minors. But then you get into Section 1, and that was really what I heard from the opposition, that they support the rest of the bill, but Section 1 causes problems. And I guess I'll just vocalize the concern it has for me. What Section 1 will do is inject state government into the operation of private entities and individuals. A sole proprietorship running a restaurant, we're going to say you cannot run your business the way you want to run your business. Now, there is a place for that. But my position has always been that if we're going to step across that threshold, and if we're going to interject into the operation of the operation and ownership of private property, private businesses, we must have a compelling public interest. Now, when we passed the smoking ban, you could argue there was a compelling public interest. Some people agreed, some people disagreed, but you could make the argument. The science was behind it. I can't find anything here that says secondhand vape, for lack of a better term, I don't know what else to call it, is an immediate threat to those nearby. And barring that kind of strong evidence, I can't find the compelling public interest. I think talking about theoretical possibilities of people smoking weird stuff in electronic cigarettes is a bit of a stretch to try to claim there's a compelling public interest. If that was happening, and I'm not aware of it happening in public now, maybe it is, but I've never heard of a case. If that becomes a compelling public interest and the evidence has showed that this is a problem, then we can have that conversation. But for me, we haven't crossed that threshold, and I like everything about, I don't necessarily love it all, but I like everything in the rest of your bill, but Section 1 really is a problem for me.
Thank you. Senator Benson.
Madam Chair, I'd move to strike Section 1.
Senator Benson has moved to strike Section 1. Is there a discussion? Senator Sharon?
I strongly recommend that the committee defeat this amendment to defeat Section 1. It is not just a sidebar. It is a critical element. You have the survey in front of you that indicates clearly that the public is asking that they not be asked to share the risk with the persons. So they're not trying to restrict access to this for persons who choose to use it as a method of reducing their cigarettes or if they want to stay addicted, but they do not want to share the risk. And sole proprietorship or other businesses, if there's not a more compelling reason than that we require our license holders, whether they're restaurants or bars, to create a safe environment in a number of ways, then you cannot find a more compelling interest for the state to engage in asking for one small indication of our concern for the general public, and that is that in public spaces where there is a risk, an unknown risk, but a risk that the public does not want to share with those who make a choice to engage in this behavior. So we can debate that, and it really is a critical question for each member here to decide if there's enough concern for you to establish that the risk of the public should be protected or not, and I just encourage you to vote against this motion this evening.
Any other discussion on that? Senator Nino.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, after that long speech I gave, obviously I'm going to support the motion, but I'll just make one brief argument. I said that there should be a demonstrable compelling public interest before government gets into this level of regulating the operation of a business. And in Senator Sharon's own words, it is an unknown risk. In other words, we don't know what or if there is a risk to the public because there is no science demonstrating that. So for that reason, I'm going to support the motion.
Senator Benson.
Madam Chair, what we heard was we didn't hear levels of things that might be toxic, and as we know, water vapor, propylene glycol vapor diminishes concentration volumetrically. It doesn't behave like a particulate. And so without some sort of peer-reviewed study telling us at what point there is a level of toxicity, we don't really have good information as to how close you need to be sitting to someone or if across the room is sufficient. We now are also hearing for the first time tonight that the FDA is looking into regulating this. I think we'll have much more information when the FDA has gone through a labeling and regulating process. For now, I don't see sufficient evidence that individuals are being harmed that we should interfere with someone who is probably trying to get away from tobacco. The words tobacco and e-cigarette have been used interchangeably here tonight as though this is the same as tobacco. Tobacco is actually combustion. You're inhaling particles into your lungs and putting them out into the atmosphere. And as far as I can tell, nobody has demonstrated that that is what happens with vaping. And so I would like to see more evidence brought forward that there is specific components that could cause harm. Propylene glycol, I looked up the MSDS. Its biggest risk in the MSDS is slipping. And so, and that's not to be funny. I take this very seriously. Prolonged contact with skin, no harm. If it gets in your eyes, rinse your eyes. let's just be really cautious about how restrictive we want to be on something that seems to be helping people overcome a pretty bad addiction to tobacco.
Senator Wicklin?
Senator Sharon.
I think that that's why I've been a strong, making very strong statements that access to this inhaling-exhaling process is not restricted for adults who wish to choose it as a method of quitting smoking or staying addicted to nicotine. So these are not extreme restrictions. This is simply establishing that in common places where we share common air, that we not ask the public to take the risk, to wait for the outcomes that that some persons would like to see occur before we put this prohibition in place. It is not uncommon that we ask all sorts of drugs that are mood-altering chemicals to be approved as not harmful to people before they can be sold. We do research over a long period of time to make certain that they have efficacy, they in fact do what people are claiming they do, and that they do not create excessive harm. We do have precedents that indicates the government does establish a boundary in order to not create excessive risk for the public. And that's what this bill does. It's like the example that I enjoyed, which is if you see a berry, if you want to take that and risk taking it yourself, go for it. But we would not want to have it be in a situation where other people consumed it. So I think that the disagreement we can go around the table is about whether or not you're going to wait for FDA to indicate there is harm before setting this restriction, or if you believe, as I do, that and the general public has asked for, that they would like protection from the risks of this while supporting the rights of persons who would like to use this product to use it outside of shared space.
Senator Eaton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would just like to add that to me the compelling piece to this is I do not want to see cigarettes normalized. I do not want children especially to see adults going around with cigarettes. A lot of them look different, but I've seen a lot of e-cigarettes that look just like a cigarette. And I believe it was the Department of Health that testified that the use in middle school is doubled on these, and you get addicted to nicotine. You know, the other alternatives are chewing tobacco and smoking tobacco, and all of which have known risks for cancer. So I strongly think that this is an important thing that we need to do. If adults want to go on and in their own private space use these e-cigarettes, you know, that's their business.
Thank you. Senator Nelson?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, I'm going to err on the side of caution tonight and actually vote against the amendment to strike out the language that would apply the Clean Indoor Air Act to the e-cigarettes. However, I am very hopeful that we do get the information and the data that we need. I think it's dangerous when we make decisions based upon not having data. And we live in a data-driven world, and we do need to see those results. We need to get these products labeled so we can have research to indicate what are the effects, not just on the person who is vaping, but on the secondhand vape or the person next to them. And so I am missing that information. But in spite of missing that information and wishing we had it so we could make a better decision, I'm going to err on the side of caution tonight because we all know how addictive smoking is. And I remember growing up, you know, seeing all the cigarette ads on TV, and things have changed. And I think it's very hard to change social mores. And we truly have succeeded in Minnesota, I believe, in changing the expectation to that of a smoke-free environment. And so I am going to err on the side of caution because I don't want to retreat from the hard-earned progress that we have made in a healthier particularly youth picking up this habit. But in the same vein, as this goes forward, I do hope we strive diligently to get accurate scientific information about what is in the products and how it affects people and the secondhand piece.
Thank you. Are there any other members who wish to speak? Senator Sharon.
I just want to affirm that I couldn't agree more with Senator Nelson. And I was trying to, she did a better job of that, articulate that with my example about other mood-altering drugs, that we err on the side of caution before pharmaceutical companies can sell a product. We do interfere with the sale of a product because we ask that peer-reviewed processes occur over a period of time in order to give us the data that you're talking about. And I think that's critically important for us. But it also is an indication that we do not ask the public to take a risk with mood-altering substances until that is adequately resolved. So I hope that we defeat the amendment.
No.
Any further discussion on the motion? Hearing no further discussion, the question is on the motion of Senator Benson that Section 1 be stricken from the bill, be amended as that in that form. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
No.
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 The motion is defeated.
I'd like to,
Senator Sharon.
I would like to introduce a motion that Senate File, please help me, Senate File 2027 be passed or be laid on the table for. What is the motion, Senator?
Senator Sharon moves that Senate File 2027 be recommended to pass and be referred to the Judiciary Committee. The bill will also be considered for inclusion in an omnibus bill. Is that your motion, Senator
Sharon?
That
is my motion. Thank you.
Is there any other discussion? All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? The motion passes.
Thank you.
And the meeting is adjourned. Thank you.